You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here with you for your Murder Mystery World Tour. And we are continuing with Marjorie Allingham, this time her last novel, released posthumously, Cargo of Eagles, completed by her husband, Philip Youngman Carter. This book was released in the 1960s, and we're covering chapters 1 to 8 today. I'm joined for that by Lachlan, who's a producer that's been squirreling away with us behind the scenes and has kindly stepped in to fill Heard's shoes, despite having points stolen from him for doing so. Lachlan, welcome to Death of the Reader. It's fantastic to have you.
It's fantastic to be here.
Lachlan, I suppose here on Death of the Reader, we like to start things off by drilling into the characters, and the most curious character to me here on Cargo of Eagles is obviously Albert Campion. When we last met him in Trader's Purse, he was a young man just about ready to get married and was off swashbuckling and taking down criminals with weapons and fights and brawls and getting amnesia. But in this novel, he's an older guy. He's been recommended this latest job by his son. His long-standing commanding officer, Stanislaus Oates, is sitting in a quiet room dozing off to himself. It's like an entirely different world to the spy that we got to know. What were your initial impressions?
I mean, I had no experience with him before. I've never read any of the other books, so I didn't know any of that. He seems very different to how you just described him in this book. I don't know. I got the sense that he was like a bit jaded with everything.
Yeah, there was a bit of a sense where, you know, in that scene with Morty in the car at the beginning, like, he's kind of just appeasing the young upstart American who's come over to work for him.
Yeah, and I mean, Morty is like a much more attractive character to me, I guess. I find myself being drawn to him a lot more than Campion. And maybe that's just because we've only seen him, Campion, for not as much in the book so far. But Morty seems a lot more enthusiastic about everything. I have a lot of faith in him. I think he's going to do well in this.
I'm so curious about Dido, because obviously the name brings like allegories of the mythical leader of Carthage, who was wooed by Aeneas during the Aeneid. And I'm very, very dubious to see if that kind of piece of that etymology is actually going to be relevant, or whether it was just a regular choice of name by Marjorie Allingham.
We had very different conclusions with the name. I couldn't stop thinking about the song Dr. Jones when she kept coming up. So, I mean, don't even know what the Dido stuff you were just talking about is, but I assume that's probably a closer link to the book than the song that came out, what, 20, 30 years after it was published.
I mean, who knows? Maybe the song was based on this character.
There's a chance.
I thought it was really fun as well, the idea that the town of Salty, which is kind of our, it's not necessarily our setting for the book. We don't start there, but it seems to be the focal point to which we're being drawn. There's very much the image of the Salty Sea Dog smuggler who brought all of the goods into this small town outside of London, and how that like town is now all villains because of this historical facet of its past. Like, somehow they can't escape the hundreds-year-old piracy that was going on there.
Yeah, it's got a very, what's the word? Like, not isolated, but it's its own place. And I can't imagine anything legal happening there very often. It's a very good setting for a mystery book, I think.
It is. It's also so weird because I guess, like, you know, we have these like this gang almost that's roaming Salty, and one of the last things that we get in chapter 8 is a discussion about how, you know, all of these new drugs, the cocaines, the marijuanas, the heroines, are like ruining the youth. Back in my day when we were just smuggling rum and cigars, it was, you know, not nearly as bad for your health.
Not at all.
It was like, it was very weird to see a like back in my day take that I was like, yeah, you know what? I guess that is kind of true.
It's like at the moment there are a lot of Twitter threads of people posting screenshots from newspapers from like 100 years ago going, people don't want to work anymore. It's the same sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. There's that the cafe owner or whatever that they're talking about when we first get introduced to Dido straight up says that. She's like, oh, the new girl in my cafe ran off.
It's the same narrative over and over again.
It's so funny. And I think that's one thing that like makes Campion so fascinating in this novel is the way that I feel he's being portrayed is that he very much seems like he's coming to terms with the fact that the narratives are the same, right?
Yeah. The closest comparison I've got is, and this is only from the BBC show, The Sherlock Show. He reminds me very slightly of Mycroft and Morty kind of Sherlock. But again, that's just the show. Maybe it's different in the books. And there was a lot of tension going through it. I've definitely felt a lot more drawn into it than I expected to be. And I think Campion and the dynamic going on there was a big part of that.
Yeah, I guess the other thing is not being nearly as versed in murder mystery as perhaps Herds and I are, Lachlan. You know, we have our murder in this being Hector Askew, who's shot with a silver bullet.
I was shocked. I was just getting to know him and I was like, yeah, I like this guy. And then the next chapter, he's dead and I'm shocked.
I mean, the other thing that's really interesting is that, of course, when we find Hector Askew, we have that like really haunting, creepy scene where we're walking in and there's music playing in this house as Dido and Morty are searching for him. And like, you know, it's this big dramatic scene staging for the murder that seems far too complicated for him not to be wrapped up in something. Like, you know, someone wouldn't have dressed it up this much if he wasn't involved in something nefarious.
I am very eager to find out what, because it's confusing me a lot.
Yeah, I guess the other character that I wanted to talk about right now is Stanislas Oates, who I mentioned earlier. He was the old spy master character and sort of spy ally of Campion in the last novel that we covered, Trader's Purse.
Yeah, he's like almost Grandpa Joe from Willy Wonka. He's just sitting there watching everything else go, but he...
as soon as the golden ticket shows up, he's out of there.
He's ready to go.
Yeah, I guess the other curious thing like with Stanislaus and Campion as characters is that Stanislaus kind of gives Campion the information to help him go along this case, which Campion then passes on to Morty, who then passes it on to Dido. This like chain of command idea that you don't often get in spy novels because it tends to just be the spy master talking to your protagonist.
Honestly, it got a bit hard for me to follow along with all the names, so I'm glad I was taking notes as I was reading along. But it was interesting to see how things were passing on, and like you would find something out from one character and then a few pages, chapters later, it would reach down to whoever, Morty or Dido or anything. As we go on, I don't know at what point her husband took over the writing, but I'll be interested to see if it keeps that tone or if it gets a bit lighthearted as we switch over.
Yeah, it's one thing I'm really curious to talk about in the next couple of episodes, because I don't think, to me, there is a point where the switch happens, but at the end, you definitely get the sense that, like, this isn't how the book began. I guess we should probably wrap this part of the discussion here and get over to the mystery section where, Lachlan, you are set to pose your first theory on Death of the Reader after many, many weeks of listening to Herds and I ramble about our various concoctions.
I'm feeling confident. I think I've got a good one ready to go.
That's what I like to hear. This is Death of the Reader. We are talking Marjorie Allingham's Cargo of Eagles. I'm joined by our producer, Lachlan, stepping in while Herds is away. And we'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here with you. I am joined on the line right now by Mike Ripley, author of the Albert Campion continuation novels, a crime reviewer and author from over in the UK. Mike, it's fantastic to have you here on Death of the Reader. Welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be on.
So the first thing that I wanted to get into today is, in the world of Albert Campion, you've been continuing on this series of novels since Mr. Campion's Farewell. And the latest one, Mr. Campion's Mosaic, I believe is meant to come out in just a couple of weeks as we speak right now. Can you tell me a little bit about Mr. Campion's Mosaic?
I think it's next week, actually. It's due out. It's the 10th continuation I've done. And I'm going to have to stop soon because it'd be terribly embarrassing if I wrote more Campion books than Marjorie Allingham did. But it's my Campion is now age 72, and it's set in 1972. And he's involved with, there's a sort of flashback to a previous book, Mr. Campion's Sales, which introduced a golden age crime writer called Evadne Child, with a complete bibliography of her books. Of course, she doesn't exist. I made her up. But one of those books is now being filmed, and it involves stealing a Roman mosaic floor, which is quite a task in itself, if you think about it. And Campion gets involved because somebody is clearly trying to sabotage the television production. And it's all the usual madness involving actors and strange people involved with show business. And the prospect of making a television series in 1972, which is a two-hour film, which mostly shot on location, which in 1972 would have been impossible because it was only several years later that sort of Inspector Morse broke the mold to do it. I was very fortunate in that one of my oldest friends was the series producer on Inspector Morse. So I got the inside track on some of the arguments that went on. So there's a television aspect, there's a weird crime, and there's the evolving story of who wants to stop the production when everybody seems to be in favor of it. Mm. And that's a mystery.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really interesting to me is that, you know, Albert Campion as a character is someone who lives between this world of Golden Age detective fiction, early British spy fiction, and kind of wove back and forth between the two, as I've seen it, as Marjorie Allingham went from story to story. Talk to me about like your Campion and what your kind of key takeaways were from Marjorie Allingham's that you brought into your own novels when you started this endeavor, and how those have changed over the years.
Well, I start with a confession that I wasn't really a fan of Golden Age detective stories. And I always said that I could never write a whodunit if you put a gun to my head. They're far too difficult. But I loved Marjorie Allingham, and I started reading her when I was a teenager. And the other main influence on me was Raymond Chandler. Now, you can't really get much different. But I loved Marjorie Allingham because she just didn't care. I mean, she didn't mind. She didn't take herself too seriously. She had one thing that the others didn't. She had a hero who aged. There's a wonderful essay she wrote in 1958 where she does a mock interview with her, between herself and Albert Campion. And I've actually got it here. And he's saying, "I can't do it anymore." Says, can't what? Says, "Hop about, pull guns, shoot lines. Pretend I like the police. Everybody knows how old I am. You make sure of that." It's called What to Do with an Aging Detective. Now, of course, she carried on. A book she wrote in the 60s called The Mind Readers, which is her attempt at a John le Carré spy novel, believe it or not. And it's pretty bonkers. But there is one chapter where Campion is in a lonely stretch of road and he gets attacked. And he suddenly realizes, sort of for the first time, that he's not strong enough anymore to defend himself. And it's an amazing passage. It's not a gory fight scene. It's just so sad and poignant. It's brilliantly written. So I thought with that, and then the fact that when her husband took over, that would be 1969, so Campion would be 69. And it seemed, you know, only fair to sort of start there and see him through. So I've continued with him as a very overactive pensioner. And he had a remarkable number of adventures, all compressed between the years 1965 and 1972. It is very odd because I have actually sort of been nominated for historical novel awards. And when we're talking about the 60s, I always maintain that any period in which I was alive isn't history yet.
I mean, the other thing that's kind of fun about Campion compared to many of his contemporaries that we think of with the Queens of Crime of the Golden Age is that Campion is very much a like patriotic hero. You know, he is a spy serving the crown to some extent. How kind of formative is that over his evolution as a character? And how do you see it now that he's moved on in your continuation novels?
Oh, I don't think that's changed. I think he always was. I mean, there's this wonderful hint that he's connected to the royal family. So, of course, he's going to support the crown and the empire. He's not as much of an empire warrior as, say, Bulldog Drummond or some of the other 1930s thriller fascists were, because he's sensible. I mean, I wrote a book called Mr. Kamkin's Abdication, which ties into a story back from 1936 and the abdication. And I wrote it because I had this opening line of, where do you think Ms. Kamkin stood on the abdication? And somebody says, oh, behind the throne, slightly to the left. And I thought that's just the sort of thing he would say. You know? And so those are the in-jokes which keep me going. I mean, that's one thing that I really like doing. I'm very proud of the fact that the reviewers and critics have said that I put the humour back in to the books that Philip Yeoman Carter lost.
Yeah.
Because Philip Yeoman Carter was not funny. He's a good writer, and he's written some excellent ghost stories, but he wasn't funny.
I think based on my limited experience thus far, I can agree.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I suppose speaking of funny characters, one of the like bits of light in a lot of the novels that I've had the chance to read since starting on Albert Campion is, of course, the extended cast. You know, Lady Amanda Fitton in Traitor's Purse is a phenomenal counterpoint for Campion's delusional state of mind, as is Lug's, you know, chagrin at not being remembered as much as Lady Amanda was.
Well, I mean, actually, you know, my books are... Mr. Lug's books, and Albert Campion just appears as a sidekick. Lug is the great hero. I mean, he's a wonderful character. And I have twisted the rules to keep him going. So, because he's slightly older than Campion, he's still kicking around in his 70s and still packs a punch and comes up with a lugubrious line. But he has always been my favorite. I mean, you often get comments from readers saying, you know, not enough Lug in the book, more Lug next time, please. And someone tries to give him a starring role, because so he's basically these two old buffers going around solving crimes and having adventures, even though they should be in theory putting their feet up in some maximum security retirement home somewhere.
Maximum security, yeah. I mean, I feel like that's kind of one of the great treats of characters like Campion and Lug, though, is that, you know, the implausibility of them being out still doing things is almost more faithful in a sense to the kind of youthful exuberance that, you know, you never really lose to some extent. Like, think of Richard Osman's The Thursday Murder Club, for example, just shows how wonderful characters can be, even if their physical ability isn't their starring feature.
Absolutely. I mean, think it was Evelyn Waugh said, never kill off a good character because a good character is so difficult to create. And Marjorie Allingham created some wonderful ones, and you know, it's a pleasure and an honor to keep them going. I mean, she also created some, I mean, it's not just them, but you're right, absolutely right about the extended cast. Because I mean, there's some, you know, I can't necessarily remember which book they were in, but I do remember characters like William Faraday, who wrote his autobiography, which was turned into a musical called The Old Buffer, which then went on to become the subject of another book, which Dances in Mourning. I mean, a brilliant character. Canon Avril in Tiger in the Smoke. Wonderful character. And I mean, he is the epitome of goodness, whereas the bad guy, Jack Havoc, is pure evil. And the two between them is wonderful. And then look out for what you must read, Look to the Lady, and watch out for the character called Mrs. Dick Shannon, who is one of my favourite baddies. She's really good and has a novel way of trying to kill Campion. I won't spoil that one for you.
Mike, I'm so delighted to have spoken with you about Albert Campion. You know, it's an aspect of the golden age of crime fiction that I don't think I'd ever really, like, you know, come across before we featured it on the show, and it's been such a joy diving into it and getting to experience both your work and the originals by Marjorie Allingham. So thank you so much for this kind of guided tour to the world of Campion.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. Mike Ripley there. We are talking Cargo of Eagles by Marjorie Allingham and Philip Yeoman Carter. Stick around, more to come here on your Murder Mystery World Tour. You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Lachlan here with you for your murder mystery world tour. Herds is on vacation and a noble soul has stepped in to fill his shoes. Now, in case you didn't hear the end of last week's show, Lachlan, Herds is going to be stealing all the points that you earn on this stretch of episodes for us. But, you know, it's going to a good cause, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I have to pick my allegiance here, and I could just throw this whole book entirely and give you the points. But...
let's not start strategizing too fast. You know, don't give the game away.
No, I'll try and play fairly.
Yeah, so I guess the curious thing that I wanted to throw to you first up, Lachlan, is that we kind of have two core mysteries here. There is what is going on in the town of Salty, where is James Teague? And then there is who killed Hector Askew. And obviously, being a crime novel, these will be related in some way. But as well as kind of posing a theory on who done it, I'd really love to know where you think that overlap happens. Why is Hector Askew's death connected to the goings-on in the town of Salty?
I mean, I can honestly say I have no idea. But I do feel like whoever this gang is that people keep bringing up, they have to have something to do with it, because there's no way we're spending this much time meeting the girl on the motorbike who got very angry when Dido tried to help her, and all these people that are taking drugs and riding around. They've got to be involved somehow. I'm just not sure exactly how yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a classic trap, right, where much in the same way that you can get to a culprit and say, oh, well, they were clinically insane and they murdered him because they were insane and end of story, everyone, we're moving on. You know, the like motorcycle riding, drug wielding pirate gang is an easy out, I feel. Like, you know, surely the connection goes a bit deeper than just the violence of the town.
Of course. I mean, I will be disappointed if we get to the end and it's just like, oh yeah, the people riding motorbikes did it because they were on drugs or whatever. Feels like a bit of a cheat. I do think as well that you were saying the insanity. It just seems like everyone in Salty is like, at least to some degree, a bit insane.
I know, it's so weird.
The guy that's running the demon, him and his wife, they could not be more different as... the way they interact with Morty, one of them.
It almost feels like a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde routine, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and it is really interesting that there is that diversity in the town as well, where, as well as having, like, the bar that has two faces, you know, there's the suggestion that there's a conspiracy of people who have all come to tear apart the will that was handed to Dido Jones, and, you know, aside from just keeping outsiders out of this small town, why do you think they're targeting this doctor who has only really been helpful to their community?
I mean, this is where we get into the main theory I had. I don't know if I meant to reveal that yet or not.
Absolutely.
Well, my theory then is that Dido Jones has got something to do with this. I don't think she's just some doctor who happened to meet a patient that gave her a house. I feel like there's got to be something deeper there, whether she's, I don't know, involved with this secret network of smugglers. Maybe she has something to do with Teague. That's a possibility, because I remember there being a woman, an unnamed woman, who was writing him letters while he was in prison. Maybe that could be her. I'm not too sure. I don't know if that matches up with all of the clues we've got so far, but that's my thinking.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And as well, going back to what I was saying in the first part about, like, the character of, like, ancient Dido, you know, in that story, the whole bit ended up being that Aeneas was going to stay only for the gods to come down and say, excuse me, stop being horny, leave this place and go settle Rome somewhere else. And I very much get the vibe with your theory that that's kind of the same sort of thing, where, like, the gods, the town, the people don't want things to settle the way that they are for some reason. I'd love to know a bit more in depth what you think that reason could be.
From the evidence I've got, I feel like she has to have at least been in Salty before the house was given to her. She must know people, because it makes no sense for this old woman to have left the house, whether she even was, like, even if it was, if Dido was her nurse, leaving her a whole house is a bit much.
Yeah, I mean, there is the insinuation, right, that it was because Dido was the only friend that this old woman was able to make. But the town seems like such a tight-knit, if cruel, community that can that really ring true? I guess, though, you're saying that Dido is involved in this, like, drug business somehow. Is this going to end up being a power play against what Campion and his team are doing?
Quite possibly. I mean, we heard that Jonathan Woodrose, he often goes to London, and there was the theory from this reporter that we just met in the last chapter that he is, like, helping them to get the drugs or whatever they're smuggling out of Salty and into London. Maybe Dido is working with him or helping to get things into London, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I suppose the other question is that, you know, if we're pinning the doctor as the culprit here, first of all, are we pinning Dido as the culprit of Hector's murder here as well?
I don't know if that's possible, because when they found him dead, she was, like, with Morty the whole time heading into Salty.
Well, it's true, but she also studies the corpse. And in murder mystery, when the doctor studies the corpse, you know, they're the one that calls the time of death, right? So he could have died days earlier and she's just lying because she's the one with power in that situation.
I mean, if that is the case, I'm impressed with the battery life on that radio if it was still playing days later, sitting in his hands.
The thing you haven't covered in any of this is the letter that's been signed by maybe seven different people. Do you think we've met all seven? Who do you think they are?
Surely not. We know, or we're pretty sure, that one of them is Jonathan Woodrose, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's an interesting question because the multiple culprits idea is a classic murder mystery kind of trope to throw you off the scent. The other alternatives you'll often get is letters being, like, scrapbooked together rather than written. Yeah, I mean, you always see those in, like, threat letters in spy films where it's like, oh, the jumbled together poster notes.
I'm always very impressed that they've got the time to and patience to go through those magazines. I don't know how I would find the right letters to make the words.
I guess if you're running a criminal organization, you just have to keep, like, a drawer for each letter, and you have, you know, one of your minions sitting there cutting out letters all day just to put together threat notes.
It, maybe they've got enough magazine subscriptions that it doesn't really make a difference going through it. They're bound to find the letters eventually.
I suppose so. I mean, listen, it's like you get to the end of putting together your threat letter and you're like, oh, there's one X and nobody's used one in the past four months of magazines. And
then they find out that they used the xylophone to kill the person.
Anyway, I think I'm pretty happy with the general assessment that you've given me here. There's a lot of questions that I'd still like to hear you answer in terms of how these pieces overlap, because, you know, we've got the house, we've got the letter, we've got the murder of Hector, we've got the situation with this lady in hospital, we've got the barge that was stolen by James Teague, we have the boat that they stole before stealing the barge. It is this tapestry of evidence, and how does a moment of piracy with a barge on a river outside of London connect to the property market? Like, where is the logical through line here?
You've just made me realize how much stuff is going on in this book, and now I'm really worried that I've got no chance of figuring it out.
One of those points is posing two different theories. So as many holes as there are in your theory this week, it provides you with plenty of room to band-aid it together next week.
Yeah, it's going to need maybe a lot more than a band-aid. We're going to need a whole plaster cast on this.
I mean, listen, maybe that's the secret. Maybe we've buried the clues to this conundrum in a plaster cast in a hospital by Dido Jones.
That's why you're such a professional host, bringing it full circle.
Either way, we should wrap this for this week. Lachlan, thank you so much for joining me and taking your first dive into Death of the Reader. I know it's an intimidating pool of sharks to jump into.
Very much so, but I feel like the only way I can go is up from here.
And up we shall next week with chapters 9 to 15 of Cargo of Eagles by Marjorie Allingham and Philip Youngman Carter. You're on Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3, and we will see you then.